Hey, I'm Tom Werman, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote his upcoming autobiography entitled Turn It Up, My Time Making Hit Records in the Glory Days of Rock Music, please welcome one of my favorite producers, Mr. Tom Werman. How's it going, Tom?
Great, great. Thank you very much for that. You know, a whole lot of people don't even know what a record producer does. It's nice to hear that I'm one of your favorites.
Well, here's what happens, Tom. My favorite band of all time is Cheap Trick.
Uh-huh.
So the first time I ever see the name Tom Werman is on In Color, Heaven right. Tonight, and Dream Police. Right. Now, my introduction to the band was at Budokan. So after loving that album, I go backwards and I just go, oh, Tom Werman. Oh, Tom Werman on this one. And then the new album comes out, Dream Police. Oh, Tom Werman. Well, then this guy, I'm all in on you because those records sound amazing. The band has never sounded better in the studio than with Tom Werman. I don't care who they worked with, whether it was George Martin, Roy Thomas Baker, Todd Rundgren, whoever it was, these three records and the first album with Jack Douglas is fantastic. But the three albums that you did are the best the band's ever sounded. And I will tell you that Heaven Tonight is in my top three favorite albums of all time with Who's Next and Hotel California. I mean, it's just phenomenal. So
that's close. Very close to my selections, too. Who's Next is way up there.
Way up there.
You know, and, you know, Revolver's in the top five. And anything, Eagles, love the Eagles. Anyway, I'm a, you know, I'm kind of a pop guy, not really a metalhead. Right. And Cheap Trick, as you saw, as you read in the book, spoiled me for everyone else. They were my favorite band to work with. I wasn't that positive when I signed them, when I recommended that we sign them. They were incredibly loud in the small club that I saw them in first. And but in the studio, they were just fantastic. Everything was great. And I happened to feel that Heaven Tonight and Dream Police are probably my best work. I'm happiest with what I did on those albums.
Well, I mean, when it comes to Cheap Trick, and, you know, I'll praise them from, you know, the highest mountain, everyone is excellent in the band. Individually, they're excellent. Rick Nielsen with those songs back in the day when he was the sole songwriter. Robin with that voice that can scream and then sing a ballad, and then just sound different at all times. Tom with that thick 12-string bass, and Bunny, just amazing. He doesn't need to have the biggest kit in the world. Whatever that kit is, he's making it sound big. So those four together, and I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction when they in Brooklyn when they were inducted, and I was so happy that Bunny mentioned Tom Werman.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, he, you know, Rick and I have had some disagreements about what actually happened in the studio back then, most likely within Color and with I Want You to Want Me and the piano specifically.
I need you.
but damn nice of Bunny. And I also just kind of like Charlie Watts, Bunny is really great for what he doesn't play. As for what he does play, he's minimalist and tasty, and you know, just a lot of fun to work with, and lightning fast.
Yeah.
In terms of getting things done.
Now, Tom, I love this book. Many times when I have someone on that has a book out, I just leaf through it and find some, you know, I find some things here and there. But I was had a trip to New York last week, so I took this with me and I read the whole thing. The weird takeaway from this book, though, is that a band who is looking for the breakthrough and the big time success hires Tom Werman. And then yeah. they achieve that multi-platinum success that they've wanted from the time they've been in the clubs. And then after the fact,
yeah.
they diss Tom Werman. What yeah. the fuck is what I'm going to say?
Really? I've said it a lot of times myself. There were two or three. They're really three people who apparently found a lot of fault with the gold and platinum albums that I made.
Right.
With them, you know, principally Dee Snider. And I don't want to devote much time to the guy, but that was one of the most puzzling developments that I ever witnessed, you know, after the making of the album, and especially after the album sold like 5 million copies.
Yeah.
You know, in one of the, probably the last written response to something he said in, you know, some trash talk, you know, he made about me in some interview. I think I finished with something like, please just go enjoy your privileged life, D. You're welcome. You know,
yeah.
that's the way I feel. I mean, that album was basically the, you know, responsible for the comfort in his life. I don't know. He was very nice during the making of the record.
The album Stay Hungry, which you produced, which was the breakthrough everywhere. That's the one that everyone owns. That's the reason why if Twisted Sister wanted to get together next summer and go out on the road, they could go out on the road. It's not because of Come Out and Play, which sucks. It's not because Love is for Suckers, which sucks more. It's because of Stay Hungry. I just don't understand a guy like Dee Snider. And Twisted Sister's never been my thing anyway. I did watch that documentary. They seemed like they were hard workers, but they needed a Tom Werman. And you gave them what they wanted. Do they want to just play clubs in New York? Or do they want to be world famous, multi-platinum selling artists?
Right. Then huge in Europe. I gave them what I think I gave them what they needed, not necessarily what they wanted. All the bands want to be, they want to rock harder.
Yeah.
You know, and my job was to get these bands on the radio.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, when I say what they wanted, I mean worldwide success and radio airplay. That's what they're, when you get into this, you know, that's really what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a strange thing. I think the only logical explanation is that he worked on with the band, on the band, for the band, with JJ. They were really the kind of the founders of the band.
Yeah.
For many, many years, they worked and had this belief. And then this producer with some credibility comes along, who's had a lot of gold and platinum records, and makes a big hit record with them. And he says, why give this guy credit? I'm the guy who did this. I wrote the songs. You know, this is my band. And I just don't think he was willing to share any credit at all. So he continued to insist that I destroyed the album.
Well, look, the proof is in the pudding. And I can't imagine selling that many albums and then not wanting to go back and work with the guy who helped do that. Instead, we get Leader of the Pack.
Hey, you. It's a seagull stinkaroo.
Hey man, is that your ring she's wearing?
Man, it must be Ray riding with her. We've been picking up after school today. By the way, where'd you meet her?
I met her at the candy store. She turned around and smiled at me and got the picture.
Yeah, we see.
That's when she fell for. Folks were always putting me down.
Down, down.
They said I came from the wrong side of
town. Right. Come on.
And aside from getting Leader of the Pack, he really lambasted me for suggesting that they might consider a Saxon song, you know, to cover a Saxon song.
Yeah.
Strong Arm of the Law. And then they go and release Leader of the Pack. I mean, not only is it a cover song, but it's a weak cover song.
It's garbage, and it's not what they say they want to be. They want to be hard rock. They work with the Scorpions producer, and then they do that drivel. And moving on. Back to Cheap Trick real quick. Each album just kept getting better, and then after Dream Police, I totally get where, after working with you for three albums, they get a chance to work with George Martin. No one's going to argue that. They worship the Beatles. It's a dream come true for them. Yeah. So I'm sure you even understood it.
Oh, absolutely. How can you complain about, about a band choosing to be produced by George Martin?
Yeah,
I was lucky enough to spend most of an afternoon with him in London. I love the guy. He was a gentleman, a smart guy, a musical genius, everything. He's a wonderful man. And at the same time, I have to admit that I had just a teensy weensy bit of satisfaction that even a George Martin didn't make a hit record with the band I had three relatively good hit records with. You know, I always thought Cheap Trick should have been, as I'm sure you did, much bigger than they were. I mean, they were, you know, well known and famous and they sold well, but I thought they should have been enormous.
And those rumors ain't nice. And when I fall,
Yeah, they're, I mean, look, and again, it's my favorite band of all time, and they're big, but they're not household name big still.
Right.
Now, you've heard All Shook Up, the album. I'm sure you listened.
I've listened to some of what they did after Dream Police. Not all of it. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, if you would have worked on All Shook Up, what would have you done different? Because I like the album, but for me, I don't feel like the songs were quite there.
You know, I don't remember.
Okay.
The track list. I have to admit, I don't think I would have done anything different. You know, Rick was contributing more and more to the production of each album.
Okay.
As we went along, and I think it would have been kind of a collaboration between him and me, and I think we would have gone somewhere new, but I, you know, logically don't know where that would have been. We did a lot of experimenting in the studio. It was fun, and we could do that because they were all really proficient at their own instruments, including Robin's voice. I did a few things that were wacky. When I worked with them, we tried some things that, you know, worked.
Yeah. It's funny, back in the day when you didn't have the internet and all these outlets to get your information, whether it's true or false, you know, it was just music magazines like Circus and Cream. And every time a new Cheap Trick album would come out, I was always hoping, is it going to be Tom Werman? Are they going to get back with Tom Werman? And then it just never happened for me as a fan. But
well, they did call me at one point. I think they were without a deal at that point.
Okay.
Maybe they had been or were about to be on Warner's. But they said, come on out and produce our demo. We want a new demo. And they were going to, you know, shop it to labels. I said, yeah, I went out to Rockford. We did four songs. And I remember playing tambourine on one of them. And, we mixed them. And then all of a sudden, with no credit, no money, nothing, it's the first single on their next album, you know, and it was the exact same mix. I'm pretty sure.
What song? So, what song do you want to mention? Say what song that is.
If you can recall, I can't remember what it is, what it was. It was good.
All right.
But I cannot remember the name of it. We're talking 40 years ago.
Yeah, of course. Sure. Absolutely.
But I should remember the name, but of course.
There's a lot. There's a lot in your head.
Yeah. There are thousands of guitar solos, note for note, that are taking up valuable memory cells that should contain other things more important.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom. You don't really have any social media presence, no Twitter, right. No Instagram, no website either.
I have a website, a recent website that somebody set up for me, and I do occasionally deal with Instagram. Okay. I'm a technical idiot. I know nothing. I depended on my engineer completely, and people think I'm an audiophile. I call myself a technoramus, combination of technology and ignoramus. I'm just not very good at that.
Reading the book, the biggest revelation for me was Molly Hatchet, because Molly Hatchet was never really on my radar. I didn't know. Look, such a revelation that I purchased these five albums after reading the book. You produced the first five studio albums for Molly Hatchet, and those things were platinum and multi-platinum. I didn't even realize that they sold that many albums, because where I lived in Western Pennsylvania, that music wasn't being played. Their music wasn't getting to me as a teenager.
Really? Even Flirting with Disaster?
Well, that's the one I knew. Everyone knew Flirting with Disaster, but anything else. And I always saw those really cool album covers, you know, in the record racks, but I only knew that one song. I mean, I read about them in the book. Let the audience know a little bit about these guys. Were rough and tumble guys.
They were, you know, from broken families. Some of them, I was told that Duane Roland was shot by his father. But he was fine. He was one of the great unsung guitar heroes of my life. Unbelievable guitar player. And you can hear that. On the albums, there were three guitar players. Duane was by far the best. Dave Lubeck was second best, and then this guy Steve Holland was not anywhere near as good as the other two. But they did do the three guitar lineup thing that, you know, Southern bands did.
Yeah,
and I didn't want to diss them, but I used to call them occasionally. I'd call them the poor man's Lynyrd Skynyrd. And they were, you know, they were different, but very Southern. And, I enjoyed them. I never had, never could have imagined myself, working with guys like this.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, even when you see the press photos of these guys, if you saw these guys at the bar, you would never think that they were in a multi-platinum selling rock band ever. They just look like a bunch of good old boys. It's just like
they were.
And it's fascinating to me. You worked with both singers, Danny Joe Brown and Jimmy. I'm not sure I know how to say his last name. Farrar.
Jimmy Farrar, probably Farrar.
What was
Farrar? Right.
Farrar. Farrar. What can you tell us? Who did you like one better? Were they both excellent? What's your opinion?
They were all really nice guys.
All right.
Danny Joe was a kind of a big teddy bear. Really good guy. And Jimmy was great. But anytime something went wrong, he would always say, "Holy Jesus, holy Jesus." I used to crack me up. They were not pretty faces, Jimmy especially.
Yeah.
But and I'm so saddened by the fact that none of them is left alive. They're all dead. And they were considerably younger than I was. And I just think it was an unhealthy life. A lot of drugs, a lot of McDonald's. I don't know. They had different standards of living than I did. And as I said in the book, they'd always ask me to go out to a bar with them after work. And I always said, "That's okay. Thank you." Because, you know, frequently it would end up, you know, violently. Yeah. But they were good natured, but they actually liked to fight.
they were living for the moment. They weren't living to retire. Right. It sounds like they enjoyed the music, the partying, the fighting, all of it. So look, they might have packed more into their short lives than I'll ever pack into mine, but I'm happy to not do what they're doing.
You might live a long life.
Right, exactly. All right, let's move on. Talk about Poison. Open up and say, five times platinum, their biggest album, three top 10 singles, and then the fourth single goes to number 12. So...
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
I thought it was four top tens, but
well, it might be. I have Fallen Angel going to number 12, but you know, Wikipedia. What are you going to do? But
right, a good time. Your mama can't dance. You mean
every rose has its thorn?
Dance every rose, and that was the other one. Fallen Angel, I guess it.
Fallen Angel is the other one,
right?
Which I love. I love that song. I mean, I love a story song, and that's a great one. But this is Poison's best album. They had hits after this, but as far as a piece of work, this is their best album. And Why did they choose why did you not work with them again? Whose choice was that? Were you not available? Did they not ask you?
I think they didn't ask me. We were very, you know, we got along very well before and after, during everything. It's not unusual for a band to bounce around from producer to producer. I'm not sure why. And I don't remember how long it was between albums. In fact, I don't even remember who did their next album. Who, do you?
I would have to check. I'll check it because I do want to know. But it was someone of note because, you know, after selling 5 million albums, you're going to be able to, you know, pick who you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's certainly someone of note.
I don't know. You know, I think many bands, let's see, I left two big bands and then the rest of them, I think, just... were elected to go with somebody else after I did one or two or three or five albums with them. But it's not unusual for a band to switch producers at any point, really, even if they had a lot of success and enjoyed working with one producer. Jimmy Iovine once said, after three albums, you should shoot your producer.
the follow-up was produced by a great producer, Bruce Fairbairn.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know,
Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, he did great work with Loverboy, so many bands. So, look, I get it. I understand. But I also don't understand, like, hey, we just, look what we did with this guy. Let's use this guy again. I kind of, you know, that's just how I am.
They can do that. I mean, they can fire you too. I mean, you know, it's interesting that Nikki Sixx has had some bad things to say about me and about the sound maybe of those albums, a little too pop, a little too lightweight. Meanwhile, the band hires you. They can fire you. Mm-hmm. So why did you use me again? Twice. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's you know, record producers, the bands typically say that record producers made them do this, made them do that, wouldn't let them do this or that. That's complete fiction. Record producers don't have authority. They're hired hands.
Yeah.
You help us make this record, we'll pay you. And that's it. I mean, I can't go into the studio. Even a multi-platinum, you know, record producer can't go in the studio and tell a band what to do.
Yeah.
You can make suggestions. That's why you're good, because you make good suggestions. They try them, and if they like them, you use them, and they work. If not, you don't force them. You just say, okay, let's try something else. You don't like that? Okay. It's strange. And again, I would hear a song. I would become attracted to the pop elements of the song, the stuff that you could sing in the shower because it's memorable. And I would, you know, try to identify the weakest part of the song and either get rid of it or improve it. So, you know, when I made the records sound the way I wanted them to sound, they were not as grungy or rough or hard as they wanted them to be. You know, I was neater.
What happens if when you go in with the band, you don't like the songs, or doesn't that matter whether you like the songs or not? Because, and I'm going to be honest with you, Theater of Pain and Girls, yeah. Girls, Girls are not good albums for me. They sound good, but we got Home Sweet Home. We got Wild Side. We got Girls, 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 maybe a couple other songs here and there. But for the most part, those are not good listening experiences for me.
I get it. I think my favorite song that I ever did with the band is Wild Side.
It's great. It's undeniable.
But that's the one and two right there.
Yeah.
Girls and Wild Side, and can't remember too much of the rest, not because it was bad necessarily, but the songs weren't memorable. And if it were not for Home Sweet Home, we just don't know what would have happened to Theater of Pain.
I know. I agree.
It was tough for them because they had been on the road beating their brains out. They had to come back in and get the album done and write 12 new songs in a very small amount of time. A lot of stress, self-medication. There you go.
How do you work with a Robin Zander and then get into the studio with a Vince Neil? Because I have to be honest, I've seen them live. I've seen him solo live, and I've seen him with Motley Crue. And look, Tom, I'm not trying to be negative this whole time. I'm just giving you my opinions. He's one of the worst live singers I've ever heard in my life. I don't know how anyone gets a good performance in the studio, but they do. But he doesn't sound live like he does at all in the studio. How do you do it? It's magic.
Time and composite tracks. You know, you probably read the way I do vocals. I try not to wear the singer out. Mm-hmm. But there was one day when we worked all afternoon and I kept one line. Meanwhile, Robin would do two songs, double the lead and put harmonies in the choruses. And, you know, it was amazing, one to the other. But Vince was a you know, a trooper. He would party all night, even though he had to come in the next day and sing. But then he would come in the next day and sing and wouldn't be in great shape.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, you know, but he would try. It was tough. It was tough.
Yeah. And I mean, you're not speaking out of turn. They might be more well known for their offstage antics than for their music, to be honest. And they kind of lean into it too. It's a group of guys that never takes ownership of their past mistakes. Like at a certain time in your life, you're mature enough to where you're like, yeah, that wasn't cool, or this wasn't cool. They seem to still think that stuff was cute. That's how they come across to me.
What stuff? Like throwing televisions out of the hotel room?
Yeah. You know, being, you know, every bad thing they've done. I mean, if I was going to break it down to three words, it would be very harsh. So I won't.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to have any remorse for the things they did off stage. That's just me. That's how I see it. But anyway,
I think that's probably true. Tommy probably regrets hitting Pamela or shoving her.
I hope he does.
You know, and Nikki probably regrets wasting some time under the influence of heroin.
Yeah.
But generally, no. They, I think they enjoy the fuck the world, yeah, you know, attitude and the fact that they don't have to play by the same social rules as everyone else.
Yeah, true.
You know?
Let's talk about a band that I think should have had some success, more success.
Yeah.
The Producers.
Yeah.
What's He Got should have been a gigantic hit song. And when I saw that video, they reminded me of Cheap Trick in their quirkiness.
Yeah, absolutely. So, absolutely. I thought they were an absolute Grand Slam home run, no doubt. And I was really disappointed that I let them down. The label let them down. I mean, I do blame this one on the label, but we made two albums and, you know, they're brilliant musicians, brilliant band and catchy and great looking and, I mean, I don't. There wasn't anything missing.
Yeah,
except perhaps a perseverance by the label. I don't know, but there are so many great songs and so many great arrangements, and Kyle Henderson so talented. You're right. That was it. and Mother's Finest, both from Atlanta, both around the same period. And I thought they were both going to be massive hits, and they both wound up being cult bands, really.
It's true. Epic Records, the label you worked for at the time, they pass on Kiss, Rush, and Lynyrd Skynyrd.
All right.
When those bands eventually get signed to other labels and are wildly successful, do you get to tell anyone, I told you so?
Yeah, that's why they let me sign Ted Nugent.
Okay, because they didn't want to let another one get away.
Well, yeah, right. They said, are you interested? What happened was my boss, who was a great guy, but who had passed on those three bands when I brought them to the label, he left. And the guy who replaced him said, Werman, what have you been doing here for 5 years? And I said, well, I signed REO Speedwagon, and then I tried to sign. And he said, oh, well, and he didn't know that.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, is there anybody you like now? And I said, well, yeah, I actually like, I'm interested in Ted Nugent. Again, I want to stress, no politics involved here.
Yes.
None.
Yes, it's just the music. Everybody,
yeah,
I'm on the same page as Tom from reading his book. We're liberal guys. In 2023, we don't agree with Ted Nugent politics or how he presents himself, but we're going back to mid-70s and just focusing on those studio recordings and hit Ted's work ethic and, you know, playing that guitar.
And, you know, and his integrity,
mm-hmm,
and truthfulness and his lifestyle. I'll remember certain things about, you know, meeting Ted and getting to know him a little before we went into the studio. One of the things, he took me around his farm and, you know, we talked about hunting and guns. And I said, I could never kill an animal. And he said, you eat hamburgers? He said, you just have other people kill the animal for you in a terrible way.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my alternate education through Ted Nugent. There were some times when I could see the other side of the argument. Although, yeah, there is a big difference between us politically.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a postcard in the book,
yeah,
that Ted wrote you that says the mix and the whole LP is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And he's right. Those, those three studio albums and Double Live Gonzo are classic records. Derek St. Holmes, I always felt that this guy should have been a household name. He was great looking, sounded great. He wrote the song Hey Baby. And what do you think happened? Why wasn't the trajectory of this guy's career bigger?
Well, I don't know if anyone in Ted Nugent's band or who works with and for Ted Nugent, it's a real tough job to become bigger than Ted Nugent.
Yeah.
So I don't know what kind of help or promotion, you know, Ted offered Derek, but he was definitely second guy in the band. I really enjoyed him as a person, and I thought he was very talented. He was kind of a screw up when we did the first album, and that's why Meatloaf.
Yes.
He took his place for, I don't know, three or four songs on there. But Derek did some very nice demos later on, and he sent them to me, but we didn't get anywhere with them.
Yeah.
But he is, you know, he's very good. I don't know. I know he's been playing a lot since then. I think he spent his life playing music.
Yeah. And he
I really liked him.
And he regrouped with Ted twice, and, you know, and has done tours, and he's made a couple albums with Brad Whitford of Aerosmith. So, but yeah, he's just a guy I always liked, and I liked his voice, and I wished he was also bigger. But
yeah, there was Whitford St. Holmes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me ask about REO Speedwagon, because when you signed them, Kevin Cronin is not the singer at that point.
No.
And Epic Records, this would never happen now. REO Speedwagon makes many albums before they hit on success.
Yeah.
Were they making the label any money, or did they owe the label money and so they had to keep working? Because I don't come into REO Speedwagon until High Infidelity, and then I work my way back.
Yeah, most people didn't.
Yeah.
I think they were moneymakers right from the start.
Okay.
Real road dogs. I think they really enjoyed being on the road, and they really enjoyed what they did, and they were very good live. And, you know, and then I don't know, I forget, why did Terry die? I can't remember what happened to Terry Luttrell, the original singer. Kevin really brought a strong commercial component into that band, you know, and I think it's great. They've been on the road for 53 years.
And I know Gary Richrath is no longer with us, and he wasn't in the band for quite a while in recent years, but a highly underrated guitarist.
Yeah.
Like he would slip a solo into, you know, an AM radio top 40 hit that was just fantastic. And I used to love that.
Yeah. I've worked with some really good guitar players.
Yeah.
And he was, I didn't work with him, but I sure enjoyed their playing. I mean, they were I was with Epic for 2 months when I found them and signed them. They were brought to the label by an independent engineer who had basically finished the record and brought the acetate in. And I heard those two songs, Sophisticated Lady and 157 Riverside Avenue.
Yeah.
And I said, I got to go see this band. And that was it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Another great signing, one of the best debut albums of all time. You can't argue it. You may be sick of hearing it, people. It's on the radio still. But that first Boston album is just a monster.
Yeah, it was, well, you know, it was the biggest selling debut album in the history of recorded music for a while. And then I think it may still be, I'm not sure. But I think it's around the 20 million mark now.
Yeah.
That was, you know, just a piece of luck. And Lenny Pizzi, who was the Boston regional, the New England regional promotion manager, knew their manager. Their manager came in, brought him the record. He brought the record down to me. We listened to it in my boss's office, and we flipped. We just flipped. And I could not believe that anybody else had passed on this band. And every label that Paul Ahern apparently visited that day passed. You can't pass on more than a feeling.
No.
I mean, come on. You have to be deaf. You know
what, like, what weren't they hearing? I don't understand.
I have no idea, but I'm grateful. It was one of the great moments of my life, hearing that album finished. Shoals, the more you learn about Boston, the more you discover that Shoals did everything, basically everything,
except, I mean, the singing.
Guys,
except,
I mean, talk about guitar players.
Yeah.
He was a Polaroid engineer, an MIT graduate, you know, not looking like your average rock star.
No.
And he invented the Rockman. I mean, geez, this guy was really something.
And then that Bradley Delp on vocals, just a great, yeah, great rock vocalist. So good.
Oh, oh yeah. Yeah. It was a great band, and he put it together, I think, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think he put it together during the time between when we first heard it at Epic Records and that Thanksgiving vacation. It was maybe a few weeks or maybe a month before we could see them live. And as you can imagine, they didn't live up to the recorded version.
Yeah,
but it was good enough for me. It was good enough, and then the rest is history.
And also, that album has iconic cover artwork.
Yeah,
that flying guitar. Some people don't even realize it's a guitar. I know people that are like, "I didn't know that was a guitar for like 10 years."
Right,
it's true. I thought it was a spaceship.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Let me tell people this real quick. The book comes out November 21st.
Right.
You're hearing this right now today, whether you're listening to this episode, it'll be November 16th for you. So pre-order this book, you'll get it next week, and you're going to burn through this thing and have so much fun reading Tom retelling all the tales from his life. It's just such an easy read. It just flies by. You can drop in anywhere you want, but I say read it cover to cover because you're going to just dig this thing.
That's great that you say that. And a lot of people actually use those Same words. It's an easy read.
That's not a diss. That just means it just flies by. It's so entertaining.
That's great. That's really great. I think a lot of people are surprised that I can actually write.
You know what I like too, Tom, is that you don't just sit back and take it when someone says something, tries to change history or the past about something you were involved in. I'm not like that either. I'm like, whoa, that is not how it was at all. So I appreciate your candor. Some people won't go there, and I'm glad that you did, because I 100% believe what you say. I love Sammy Hagar's book for the same reason. He doesn't paint himself as a perfect guy, and when someone has honesty like that, that makes me believe everything in their book. So, bravo. Right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You almost produced the Eddie Money debut album.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, Jack Douglas was busy, and so he couldn't do the second Cheap Trick album when the label wanted it.
Okay.
And I had already been out to San Francisco to meet with Eddie, and I was ready to go, put a band together, but then I found out that Jack couldn't do Cheap Trick. They were looking for a producer. I was a co-producer at the time. And I was also much happier about working with a self-contained band than I was with putting a bunch of session guys together and trying to make it work for Eddie Money. It would have been my first solo production. And, you know, I went to the president of the label. And I said, you know, I'd be much happier working with Cheap Trick. And they asked me. I was very relieved, and it was a great way to get my feet wet.
Yeah.
In color. It was Rolling Stones album of the year. What a nice turn of events that was.
Right. How great is that? And Eddie Money, folks, in case you didn't know, everything went well for him too.
Yeah. and Bruce Botnick took my place.
Yeah. He did a fine job. And, sometimes I feel like Eddie Money does not get the credit he deserves for, he's such a great singer and he writes those songs too. And I think people just forget about that. And that he was a fantastic artist.
He was a very good guy.
Yes. Just a fun loving guy and family man and just a great soulful voice. And I just love Eddie Money.
Yeah.
You worked with Blue Oyster Cult, and I just wanted to give a shout out because I always love the song In Thee. As a matter of fact, I'm sure I heard it on the radio many times in my youth and didn't even realize it was Blue Oyster Cult.
Could be. It was kind of an experimental album for them. I was disappointed in its lack of success, but had a great time making it and loved Donald Roser, Buck Dharma. We laughed a tremendous amount making that record. He is a very funny guy. You wouldn't know it from just hearing the records, but I had a really good time with those guys.
You also had success with other bands such as Dokken and a former guest of the show, Lita Ford. Tell me what it was like working with Lita.
Well, it was great. It was a little late, you know, for her kind of music. Everything was changing. Seattle, you know, the Seattle sound and grunge. And so, you know, Lita and I were kind of corporate rock, you know, veterans. And she had a lot of trouble with pitch, even though she's a great singer. So what I mainly remember about that album was how I had to manually tune every line that she sang by putting her vocal track through a synthesizer with a pitch wheel. It was very, it was time consuming and difficult, but I, again, I really liked working with Lita and with Myron Grumbacker.
Oh, what a great drummer.
Yeah, Myron and a songwriter too. And a very, he was very supportive and very helpful in the studio.
And look, Shot of Poison is a fantastic song.
It is
really great.
Know, again, it's a, I think it, you know, one of the problems was it's a good song, but it's slick, you know,
it is.
And,
yeah.
And slick wasn't trendy at the time.
No. 1991.
I decided that I might be a little bit out of favor at that point. And I could, as I said, see the writing on the wall, you know, that was, I don't know. I can't remember when it was, probably early 90s.
91 is when that album came out.
Yeah. So, you know, 8 years later, I was out. I took myself out.
But after having grand success.
Yeah.
You went out a winner.
Yeah. Fortunately, I did. It was a great time to be making records because people were buying them like food.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Where do you have your gold and platinum awards? Where are they located at your house? Anywhere?
I don't have them. They were in the attic and the cellar, whatever. There were 23 of them. And what I have instead in my, I hate the term, but it's my man cave.
Sure.
You know, with a big TV and the surround sound. And I have on the wall, I think about 18 of them in two rows, perfectly placed. It's a beautiful decoration. The album covers, only nice. The album covers. No gold and platinum, that stuff. I don't go for that.
But you have them. You've kept them.
Many I don't have. I don't know what happened to them. Some warped, some, you know, they weren't extremely durable.
Okay.
The RIAA didn't do a killer job. but I wouldn't. Yeah, I just don't think it's cool. It would have been uncomfortable for me just, to have 23 gold records on the wall.
Yeah, all right. Okay. That very honest answer. I love hearing it. Which band did you want to produce, but you never got the chance to produce them?
Tom Petty.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
My meat and potatoes, that band. You know, the instrumentation, the songs, the out of the whole thing, Mike Campbell, unbelievable. That would have been great. And in my dreams, I would want to produce two bands that didn't need a producer, which would be the Eagles and the Who.
Yeah. And now here's another one.
Foreigner, maybe.
Foreigner. You would have been great with Foreigner. Oh my God. And that was a band that did use a different producer every album.
Yeah.
So,
well, Mick Jones, I think, was the brains behind that.
Yeah. Who would you come out of retirement to work with? No one would call you and you'd be like, yeah, Foo Fighters call you. You don't head over there.
Okay. That's one. Okay. Foo Fighters. Yes. Yeah. I mean, to work with Dave Grohl, you know, that would be a lifetime achievement. But really, if somebody begged me to do it, and then I would have to do it the way we used to do it. It would be analog. It would be tape, you know, and I'd have to kind of go back to where we were. I'm not interested in making records by looking at the music. I want to hear it. I want to listen to it. Nowadays, it's just all on a screen, and you can take this chunk and put it over here, and everything is perfect. And I would want it to be made organically.
All right, everybody. The book is called Turn It Up, My Time Making Hit Records in the Glory Days of Rock Music. This has been Tom Werman. Just so much fun talking to you today, Tom. I really appreciate you giving me this time. Please, everyone, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever you buy your books, and pre-order this book, and you'll have it in your hot little hands when it comes out, day of release, on November 21st. And, Tom, one last question I ask all my guests. Of all the songs you've worked on and everything you've produced, which song can I use today as my playout song for the episode?
Probably a good one would be Out Feeder Zane.
All right.
In Color.
Out Feeder Zane from Heaven Tonight.
Oh, it's from Heaven Tonight. Okay.
From Heaven Tonight, we will listen to Out Feeder Zane. Thank you so much, Tom. And continued success with this book. And enjoy retirement. You've earned it.
Oh, yeah, I am. Thank you very much. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're audio only, right?
This is audio only, and it'll post next Thursday, and then it'll live forever.
Okay. All right. And we won't.
Well, I'm hoping we do.
In one way or another.
In one way or another. Well, you definitely will then.